I am Robert Castanello, an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and you are listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast.
Ocala.
Tavares.
Daytona Beach.
Oviedo.
Apopka.
Orlando.
Lake Helen.
Winter Park.
Eustis.
Sanford.
Welcome to the Riches Documentary Podcast. Riches, the regional initiative for collecting the histories, experiences, and stories of Central Florida, is an umbrella program housing interdisciplinary public history projects that bring together different departments at the University of Central Florida with profit and nonprofit sectors of the community in order to promote the collection and preservation of the region's history. By facilitating research that records and presents the stories of communities, businesses, and institutions in Central Florida, Riches seeks to provide the region with a deeper sense of its heritage. This series will feature a podcast every 2 weeks, in the middle and at the end of each month, that will explore various aspects of Central Florida history. In today's episode, Remembering Orlando, an interview with Joy Wallace Dickinson, Part 2, Joy Wallace Dickinson gives us a tour through the rich and diverse history of Orlando based on her unique personal experience and professional research and work. From artists and historical buildings to gangsters and gambling, Dickinson proves that the local history of Orlando is fascinating and exciting in this two-part podcast.
Your book not only focuses on places and events, but on people as well, such as Charles W. Stump Jr. Could you tell us about him and his significance to Central Florida?
I started remembering Charlie Stump, who was an early weatherman on TV, during the hurricanes in 2004, when we were all glued to the television so much, and the people, the weather people, men and women, who were so important to us. And I was remembering Mr. Stump, who was a fixture, very folksy and very low tech, I mean, by today's standards. Had a chalkboard that he drew with and a real Southern accent, but was sort of a beloved figure. And everybody depended on him very much and felt like, you know, they knew they could count on him and that sort of thing. It was when TV was not that, was pretty new here. That's one of the things I should add, I think. Television stations came to Central Florida a little later than some other parts of the country. I can remember when my family lived in the north and we were in the Pittsburgh television market. We had a television and got shows in the late 40s. But when we moved to Orlando, there really was not a TV station here until the mid-50s. And so in the early 50s, what people would do was try to get the stations from Jacksonville specifically. And there were shows that were really big, like it was in the time when everybody pretty much just watched, well, the three networks were what there was. And the shows that were really big, like the Milton Berle Show or something like that. I can remember my father used to get on the roof of our house and try to adjust the antenna manually to try to get to pick up the station from Jacksonville. So there'd be a lot of snow and it would be bad reception. So when we got the first TV stations here, it was a really big deal.
Could you tell us about Tinker Field and its significance in Orlando's history?
Tinker Field is the baseball field where for a long time, Orlando had spring training here and everything. It has a great history, and I think it's on the National Register of Historic Places. And there have been attempts to revive it, and get a baseball team. It would be great if we could, but... Anyway, we'll talk about the history a little bit. It was named for Joe Tinker, who was, and this is way before my time, but a major baseball star in the teens, I think. And there was a famous triple play, Tinkers to Evers to Chance, that his name became enshrined in baseball lore through that. In the 20s, he when he retired from professional ball, he came to Orlando and was a real estate developer here. And he also coached teams here. There's a Tinker building downtown, and that's where the name Tinker Field comes from. One of the neat things that happened at Tinker Field that really I didn't know about for a long time was that Martin Luther King spoke there. He came to Orlando and spoke at Tinker Field, and I think that was the only time that King came to Orlando. But that's one of the neat events that happens there. But there used to be spring training games there, and it was very popular. Jack Kerouac, among others, when he lived in the Orlando area, used to go and watch the ball games, and Mr. Tinker did too until late in life. So it has a great history.
What is Bolita, and how did the game affect Central Florida?
One of the fascinating things to me about Central Florida's past that I think a lot of people don't realize is that there was we have a good and well-deserved kind of squeaky clean image, but in fact, there was a very active underworld organized crime here and in other parts of Florida as well. And I'm talking about maybe the 30s and earlier on up through the 60s. Might have been the heyday probably in the 40s and 50s. And I think much of it was connected with the national crime groups that are usually called the mafia. But they would delegate, those bosses would delegate some areas to folks in what's been called the cracker mafia. And that was true here. The head of organized crime in Central Florida at that time was a man named Harlan Blackburn. And his name was as well known popularly as just about anybody. Most people knew the name Harlan Blackburn. And how they made their money, I'm sure, in different ways, but the most visible one was a game called Bolita, which amounted to an illegal lottery. I mean, very much sort of like we have the state lottery. But at that time, if you bought a Bolita ticket, which you would do, surreptitiously, but widely, from a variety of people. You might get it at the gas station maybe you stopped at, sort of sold them under the table or something. You'd bet on a number or numbers, and then weekly there would be a drawing. There are different ways that it worked over time, I think, but there would be a drawing maybe in Cuba, maybe in Tampa, and a number would be drawn. And if you bet on the winning number, you could collect some winnings. But of course, the mob guys took huge profits from that and would go around and collect the winnings. So that was what Bolita was. And I think one of the things that was sort of notable is a lot of people played it. It was considered, it wasn't considered a terribly bad thing to do to bet on Bolita. A lot of people did it, I think, judging on what I've been told and, that sort of thing.
Through your research, what did you learn about places like Flamingo Club?
Well, talking about those days, those sort of days in which crime bosses frequented lots of parts of Florida, I've heard, this is before my time again, but one of the places that I've read about that I would love to have gone to if I'd been here was a place called the Flamingo Club. And it was east of town on what's now Highway 50, which ran all the way at that time, ran to the coast. But it was outside Orlando city limits, the Flamingo Club. And I think we're talking, 20s, 30s, 40s. I remember reading some articles about it in Sentinel Microfilm in the 40s. And it sounds to be like it had sort of a double life, that the front of it was a very respectable and well-regarded restaurant. And I've talked to people that went there. And restaurant and night spot, I think in its heyday, after World War II and on into the 50s, they had nightclub-style shows, entertainment imported from Havana, probably some of the folks that played the big clubs in Miami, and it was quite the place to go. But at part of its life, it had an illegal gambling casino in the back room, and at least what the articles that were in the Sentinel that I read said was that all kinds of folks of very respectable positions in town would go back there and bet on casino games. So it had quite a colorful life. I did have a friend whose dad was a waiter there in the 50s, and she said she hadn't known anything about the other, that it did. It was considered a good restaurant for the front part of it. And I'm not sure when the gambling would have been shut down.
Could you describe the art festival in Winter Park and how it turned into a $250,000 project?
One of the Orlando area institutions that's become very successful is the Winter Park Sidewalk Art Festival. And I know now so many people come to it, and it's been considered one of the most respected art festivals in the country. But it really had very simple beginnings. When a few working artists who lived in Winter Park and worked around Winter Park got together and decided to show their work. And it really was very much a sidewalk art festival, because it was out on the sidewalk and they had things hung up from clothesline, with clothespins, and very simple. Some of the artists that started it, one of them was Robert Anderson, who I remember very well because when I was a kid, I took art lessons from in the same building where Robert Anderson had a studio. And it was right back behind Park Avenue, a much sort of simpler place than a lot more homegrown businesses, drugstores, 5 and 10, that sort of thing on Park Avenue. And was very friendly to artists, though, has been for a long time. And Anderson had a studio and was a very good portrait painter and a figure of some glamour to me and my friends. He was a big man with a beard who'd lost a leg in the war and didn't make any attempt to cover up his prosthetic leg in shorts and everything. But I think he was one of the people that started it. There were about four people. And it was very simple in the beginning, but very much supported by the community.
Who is E.B. Mitchell, and what is he recognized for being and doing?
One of the figures that really interested me in the African American community when I started researching it was a man named E.B. Mitchell, who, as it turned out, became the Orlando Sentinel, the first African-American employee in the Orlando Sentinel's newsroom. He was a photographer and worked also, I think, in the darkroom that the Sentinel had at that time, but was also had a whole career before that as a private portrait photographer in the African-American community here. And one of the things I wonder, and maybe somebody knows, is where his photos went, the negatives and everything. Maybe his family has them, I don't know. But they would be a wonderful treasure trove, because I think he took weddings, he took social events. He was, if you were in the African community here then, and I'm thinking again, like 40s, 50s, you know, that's who you went to, E.B. Mitchell. And I think, you know, one of the sort of unfortunate byproducts of the end of integration, for lack of a better word, desegregation, was that what were some real strong community-based businesses in the African-American community probably no longer had such a strong base of support. I mean, it was great then that there weren't, that people weren't limited and they could say have their portrait taken all kinds of places, Olin Mills, JCPenney's or whatever, but it also eroded some of the support for some of the businesses in the community, probably like Mitchell. And I don't really know if that's the case, but he did then, after his own business closed, he went to work for the paper and became their first employee.
What is significant about Jack Kerouac and his literary pursuits in Central Florida?
I never knew this until much later, but the King of the Beats, as he was called, Jack Kerouac, lived in Orlando in the 50s for a short period of time, but it was an important period of time in his literary career. And he lived in College Park just at the time when his book On the Road was being published, and when he went from becoming an unknown writer to being a household name, and to sort of bearing the mantle of that title, the King of the Beats, which was something he hated. But he was probably buying his typing paper at George Stewart's Office Supplies right down the street and, you know, writing in College Park. So I always find it interesting to think about what great future writers are, you know, sitting around the area now working on things, or people that one might not even know about who are, you know, who will be considered great in the future.
As Joy Dickinson points out with her personal experience, professional research, and published work, Orlando and the greater Central Florida area have an extremely rich and diverse history. From buildings, locations, people, literary works, beaches, issues of race, gangsters, and speedways, Joy Dickinson has illuminated the multifaceted historical treasure trove of historical interest concerning Orlando and Central Florida, helping to open and pave the way for further examination and celebration of the area's local history.
Thank you for listening to Rich's Documentary Podcast. Feel free to contact us with any questions or comments about the program that you just heard. Please join us for the next episode, Integration and Sports, Athletic Recruitment at Bethune-Cookman University.
Felsman.
Bombay.
Geneva.
Hiddleston.
Vero Beach.
Donella.